Good evening, folks, and thanks for coming again to some of you. And if it's your first evening with us, may I add my welcome to what you've already received. If you've read anything on the topic of evolution, any standard school textbook, you'll probably be told that the evidence for evolution rests in two areas. Number one, changes that are observed in living things just now. And number two, what is recorded in the rocks by means of the fossils that they contain. I want to speak about this latter topic tonight. What do the fossils tell us? Indeed, to ask the question, is there evidence in the rocks for evolution in past ages? Many people immediately say, yes, of course. I want us to reconsider that tonight. Before we can get into a sensible discussion about fossils, we need to do a tiny bit of geology. I mean a tiny bit. We only need to know that there are two main types of rocks on the Earth's surface. To the best of our knowledge and belief, the interior of the Earth is molten. Actually, nobody's been there to see, as you'd understand, but there is good evidence that the interior core of the Earth is molten. And on the surface of this molten mass, there's a build-up of hardened material. Igneous rock, it's called. Rock that was once molten, and that rock is now hardened and crystallized. As you know, volcanoes exist which allow at times the molten lava, the molten rock, to well up through the surface where the crust has been thinned or where plates come together. But the only point I want to make about igneous rock is that we do not find fossils there for pretty obvious reasons. The types of rock that would come into this category are granite, basalt, feldspar, not so common in this part of England, I believe, but very common in many parts of Scotland. The rocks we're more interested in this evening are what are called sedimentary rocks. And by their name, you would easily understand that these appear to have been laid down as sediment during flood or floods at some point. And they're laid down in layers that can easily be distinguished. And that's where all the fossils are found. And it's not just a few here and there. Fossils are really very plentiful. If you know where to look for them, there are plenty of them. The types of rock I'm talking about are sandstone, limestone, coal seams, and shale. Again, Scotland is full of these. And I'm sorry, I can't speak for your country from personal experience more than hearsay. We're looking then at sedimentary rocks and the fossils they contain. But to show you what they look like, here's an example of igneous rock, which is actually a series of basalt columns that at one stage have welled up through the surface of the ground and hardened in this fascinating shape, usually hexagonal shape. Those of you who belong to another province will remember there's a place called the Giant's Causeway, which is another good example of this kind of thing. That one, believe it or not, is actually in Fife. So Fife is going into competition with the Giant's Causeway soon. Sedimentary rock, of course, is quite different. It is made up of layers, as you can see in that picture. These layers are often referred to as strata. And these layers are very often horizontal, more or less as they've been laid down in a horizontal plane. But very often, too, they've been tilted on their sides, some of them by as much as 90 degrees, because volcanic activity on either side has pushed them up and separated them, and many of them now lie at a certain angle to the vertical, and a few are absolutely vertical. It is in those kind of layers that fossils are found. I've given you this picture not to simply allow you to admire one of my granddaughters, but to ask you to notice that she's sitting on a sedimentary rock reef. This reef is more or less vertical. It was once down flat, it's now tilted up to about 80 to 85 degrees from the horizontal. And sticking through the middle of that rock is a fossilized tree trunk. That rock is covered with the tide, so you need to wait till low tide and get down among the seaweed, and you see the rocks are all covered with barnacles and limpets, and there's a close-up of the said fossil. It is about 1 meter long and nearly half a meter thick. It is clearly in the shape of a tree trunk. This had been a tree growing at one point in the dim and distant past, which got surrounded by sediment, swallowed up by sediment, became a fossil, and has stayed there ever since. What happened to the rest of that tree trunk, I have no idea, because I would guess that from the thickness of it, that tree must have been 10 to perhaps 20 metres tall. Part of the tree remains embedded in the rock, and interestingly, not lying in the layers horizontally, but sticking up through the layers before they were tilted over. It's called a polystrate fossil because it must mean that the rest of that tree trunk was in adjacent layers which have now been eroded by action of the sea. Let's think about fossils and ask ourselves the question, well, how do you become a fossil? Well, not how do you become a fossil, but how is it possible for a fossil to be formed? And in fact, it's very, very difficult for a fossil to be formed. It is an unusual process. Let's take these examples of fish swimming in the sea. When a fish dies, two things can happen. One is it sinks to the bottom and gradually gets surrounded by mud and gradually rots away until a few fish bones are left buried in the mud for somebody to dig up. Or, if it floats on the surface, it floats until predator fishes come along, not necessarily piranhas, because we don't get them in the North Sea, at least I don't think so. But the food chain is such that there are always predators on the lookout for an easy meal, and very quickly the fabric of a dead fish is picked off, and all that falls to the bottom are a few broken up bones. Fossils are not normal. To become a fossil, conditions have to be quite unusual. A fossil is an instantly killed specimen, which has been overwhelmed by a massive amount of sediment, so massive that it's immediately buried, and then buried by more layers on top, on top, on top. And due to the chemical composition of the sediment water, the creature becomes literally petrified, turned into stone. That is basically how a fossil is formed, and everybody is in agreement with this model of fossilization. But it's not the kind of thing that you see happening every day. In your experience, the first two pictures are more likely what we would come across nowadays. So, fossilization is an unusual process requiring very special conditions, one of which must be flooding and sediment masses. All over the world, however, fossils have been discovered, and fossils of creatures of various types, and fossils of creatures, many of which are now extinct. And because of that, those who are sure that the theory of evolution is correct have built up a sequence of fossils that they call the geological column. It proposes that over the world there may be found different layers in which different fossils exist. And furthermore, ages have been tagged on to these layers and these fossils until we have down the left-hand column, which you may not be able to read from where you are, thousands of millions of years attached. So that the lowest part, which is below the Cambrian layer, as it's called, the one above the purple, that layer goes back to around 2,000 million years, they say. And in that, you would find very simple fossils, or at least simpler fossils than the one at the top. And as you keep going up, you have a chain of not only fossilized animals, but fossilized vegetation as well, increasing in complexity as you get near the top of the column. And at the very top of the column, of course, are the mammals, including man himself. And that is what you will see in many geological textbooks. That is what you will see in many evolution-based textbooks as the basis for this theory. It is proved, they say, by the fossil record in those rocks. The actual story, however, is that this geological column does not exist in nature. The geological column is a diagram which has been drawn by artists based on partial evidence which they have chosen to put together in a particular way to tell this story. The headline claims that you will find any of the popular media will tell you this, that the fossil record grows more complete all the time, and it shows a clear sequence of change. That was on the BBC website less than 2 years ago. But actually, here's a quote, geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be used against my theory. A quote from 1859, Charles Darwin. So he's really saying, my theory doesn't depend on the geological record. In fact, if we look there, my theory is not supported. In fact, it's, well, maybe even evidence against it. But in those days, 1859 and shortly thereafter, those who immediately adopted the evolution theory said, well, we haven't found this yet, but it's early days, and we'll search as hard as we can and see what we can find, which of course they have done. And we now need to ask, has the situation changed? Well, fast forward to 1979, where a senior paleontologist, that's somebody who looks after geology, at the British Museum in London, wrote the following things. He'd actually published a book, and somebody wrote to him and said, look, in your book on fossils, you haven't really given any illustrations of those transition or evolutionary fossils. And so he had to write back to this chap and say, I agree with what you said, but actually, if I did know any, I would certainly have included it. Indeed, I lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. So after 150 years or so of really diligent searching, I mean, people pushing things to the limit to find these transitional fossils and the graduated chain of things that the theory speaks about, we're not there yet. But that was 1979. The missing links are not there, in spite of the headline claims. And here's another quote. In The Origin of Species, this book that Darwin wrote and was so eagerly adopted, he showed that the record was useless for testing between evolution and special creation because it has great gaps in it. The same argument, says this author, still applies. Great gaps. And in any case, continues this author, no real evolutionist uses the fossil record as evidence in favour of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. And the author of that quote is somebody who does not live a million miles from here, and is actually quite a recent quote. So in spite of the popular picture that's been built up for more than 100 years in schools, in universities, in evolution textbooks by the score, we're getting this story again and again, that the geological record, the fossils in it, don't really show evolution at all. So those of us who are confronted with folk who keep pushing this really need to make sure that the folk who are pushing it have read the literature and are up to date, because it really is out of date to say that the fossil record supports evolution. However, we've still to explain what the fossil record does tell us and what use it is. So let's take a few minutes just to talk a bit more about fossils and what people have deduced from the fossil record. One thing is, people will tell you, the fossils give you the age of the rocks. You'll remember in that geological column picture, there were thousands upon thousands of million years listed. And we're told that this comes from fossils that they contain. A year or two ago, I visited a museum on the east coast of England, which had many fossils in it because it belonged to what was called the Jurassic Coast. And here was an interesting label on a specimen case. It said, because plants and animals evolve over time, we can use fossils to estimate the age of the rocks. But if plants and animals don't evolve over time, fossils in the rocks tell you nothing about the age. The idea that fossils can tell you the age of the rock depends on the validity of a theory, not an observed fact. You also will find people telling you that if they find a fossil somewhere in a certain rock, then the age of that fossil is given by the rock in which it's found. So we have here a kind of a circular argument. The fossils tell you the age of the rock, and the age of the rock tell you the age of the fossil. Don't really have any independent checks there, do we? And furthermore, you will be told with great authority that the oldest rocks are thousands of millions of years old. Let's have a look at that last point. How is it that fossils tell you that rocks are millions of years old? What does this geological column really have to say to us? How old is the Earth? Many will say 4.5 to 5,000 million years. How do we know? Well, they'll tell you that certain measurements can be done on igneous rocks, which contain certain elements called uranium and lead. As every schoolboy and schoolgirl knows, uranium is a radioactive material which gives off radiation, which can be dangerous. But in the process of giving off radiation, it changes into a stable, non-radioactive substance called lead. For example, a sample might contain 1 gram of lead per million years per ton. I'm sorry, I'm reading it back to front. Let me start again. The rate for the uranium changing into lead is what I'm trying to read. The rate for uranium to change into lead, which is called its half-life, could well be 1 gram per million years per ton of sample. So you measure how much lead is in the sample now, and let's say there are 25 grams per ton in the sample just now. And simple arithmetic will tell you that the age must be 25 million years, okay? So if it grows at 1 gram per million years, and we've now got 25 grams, it must have taken 25 million years to get there. That is the basis of what is called radioactivity dating. Not radiocarbon dating, which is often confused with this. Radiocarbon dating is not any use for ages much longer than 10,000 years, not thousands of millions of years. This is using uranium as the dating material, not radiocarbon. But all these methods which are based on radioactivity depend on two things. They have assumptions built in, one of which is that the rate that we're measuring now hasn't changed over the whole time period that we're extrapolating to, that we're proposing. 25 million years is a long, long time. Can we be certain that that rate has remained the same for all that time? And furthermore, a second assumption is that there was no lead in the sample to begin with. The method assumes that all the lead that's presently in the sample came from the uranium by radioactive disintegration. But there is absolutely no guarantee that there was no lead there at the beginning. In fact, the probability is very, very high that there would be much more lead in the sample at the beginning than there would be uranium, simply because lead is so much more stable than uranium. And whatever mechanism makes the elements, and we don't need to get hung up on that, whatever the mechanism is, surely the more stable ones will be made more commonly than the less stable ones. So however you look at it, it is certainly not a guaranteed scientific measurement that the Earth is 5,000 million years old. It could be much younger than that because of these inbuilt assumptions into the method. The method assumes certain things that are probably not true. It is once again a case of extrapolation. I had this one up last night. Let me just remind you that measurements made in one area may be true and valid over that particular area. To extrapolate that to a wider area is not guaranteed because new rules may apply. And I used the example of a seal rod, which does expand uniformly between room temperature and, say, 1200 degrees C. But if you keep going beyond that, certainly up to 2,000 degrees or so, the steel rod melts and the measurement becomes meaningless. Or we can think about the growth of a child during childhood and adolescence. Growth is fairly steady and then it stops, doesn't keep growing all your life. And so I'm really saying that what we measure, what we look at in the present state of the earth, the measurements that have been made by science, which can really go back no more than 200 to 300 years, are maybe not enough valid to extrapolate to thousands of years, to millions of years, to thousands of millions of years. It's a big leap in the dark. And also, indeed, because all of this has repercussions not only to what happens on the earth, but what happens in the solar system, what happens in the galaxy, what happens in outer space. There is no guarantee that earthbound measurements and earthbound conditions will pertain in outer space. But all the things that you read about outer space and the quantities attached are based on the conditions that apply here on the Earth's surface. It is extrapolation, and that can be dangerous. That can lead to false information. Let's get back to fossils and look at the evidence for them. Here's a graph of time. As you go up the left-hand side, time is marching on. Along the bottom, I've chosen just to take an index called morphology, which is the distinction between one species and another. Animal kingdom at one end, vegetable kingdom at the other, and all the sub-branches. And the Darwinian model is that we have what is called a tree of life. It has a root, which is a simple organism, and then many branches, increasing number of branches, going all the way up until we have the life forms, the diverse morphology, the different species that exist today. So that if you trace everything backwards, it goes down this tree and all coalesces at the root. That's the Darwinian model. But the actual data, the data that we can look at both in the rocks and at present, are that there, from a particular point in the geological record, there are life forms that have persisted from then till now. Some of the fossils found in the oldest rock, as they're called, are almost identical to life forms that are around today. Others have become extinct, as shown by the short blobs. These ones have become extinct. And the other ones are samples of life forms that have continued. And what we really get is that at this point in the geological record, interpret it how you will, there is a sudden appearance of very complex creatures, which we're becoming to see more and more clearly are evidences of creatures which have been created after their kind. These vertical lines are more like a forest of trees than a single tree with many branches. So evolution theory has some problems in this area. Number one is that the earliest fossils that are found, if we take them on all that going down further and further is to the older and older rock, I highlighted a point in two slides where we have what's called the Cambrian layer, the second bottom one, and the earliest fossils appear there, but the kind of fossils that appear there are really already very complex. There are no simpler ones anywhere. This is called the Cambrian explosion of life. In other words, it appears that life suddenly appeared, suddenly exploded in diverse forms. That's what these earlier rocks would tell us. And then there's another big problem, that if there is this tree of life which branches out and we get the life forms at the end of the branches, the ones that precede them at the junction of the branches, there ought to be many of them around. There ought to be many more of them around. Extinct maybe, but they should be there. But nobody's found them yet. Every type of fossil that's been found is not a hybrid. It's a defined type that we can relate to living creatures today. And what's more, this column that I've shown you two pictures of is actually incomplete. Nowhere on all the Earth's surface do you get the complete geological column. You will get bits of it here and other bits of it there and more bits of it over here, with some of the layers coinciding between the different samples, but at no point, I emphasize that, nowhere in the whole wide world do you have the complete geological column from bottom to top or top to bottom. Fragments of it. And then the other thing you find, if you stick to the rules that have been applied by geologists and evolutionists, many strata are inverted. What they would call the older layers, the ones that should be lower down, are actually found up on top of what they call younger layers. According to the rock types and according to the fossils they contain, the strata have been inverted. They talk about inversions in the strata. And indeed, according to the model I've shown you on those slides, many fossils turn up in the wrong place. They just shouldn't be in this layer. But they are in that layer, staring you in the face. Well, not quite, but you know what I mean. They are there, and you can find them. And according to the theory, they're in the wrong place. One well-known example, which was for a long time touted as a transition between a bird and a reptile, was our old friend Archaeopteryx. On the left is a picture of the slab of rock in which it was found, and you can see the pattern of the bones, of the wing structure, of the beak. And here is the artist's impression on the right of what Archaeopteryx might have looked like. And for a long time it was said to be a part reptile, part bird, because the theory said birds evolved from reptiles, and reptile scales eventually became birds' feathers. The big snag with Archaeopteryx was that where it was found makes him older than his supposed ancestor. That doesn't quite fit, does it? So Archaeopteryx doesn't take us very far. It's an example of somebody desperately looking for a linked fossil and making the most of it until the ground is cut from beneath them by finding out that the timing is all wrong. It's older than its proposed ancestor. We're told another thing about evolution, and it is that it needs a long, long time. Really, it's salvation. The salvation of the theory is in its time. People say, well, given long enough, surely anything can happen. Well, not really, but that's what they say. But then, if you think about it, this idea of a long, long time presents several problems for evolution theory. Number one is that the longer things are around, the more they tend to reach an equilibrium stable position. And life forms are not an equilibrium stable position. As I showed you last evening, based on the second law of thermodynamics, which applies to closed systems, which therefore apply to the whole universe, the law is that gradually over time, things become less complex, not more. So all these thousands of millions of years are giving time for not bigger and better things to be formed, but actually things to get worse. Loss of variety in the biological realm. Extinction, not new species being formed. And that, of course, is what we see in our present environment. I'm sure you've heard about the concern that many conservationists have about loss of biodiversity, as different habitats are being eroded, species are put at risk, and eventually they do die out. Present studies, over as long periods of time as we can handle at the moment, show that extinction is the pattern, not new species being formed. And the longer time goes on, the more of that can happen. I also mentioned last night, and I'm going to mention it again, that the longer time goes on, energy becomes less useful. And then there's another thing. What about these ice ages that we hear about? There is evidence in the surface of the Earth that ice has at some time clothed practically all the earth's surface. Several times, they tell us, through the course of evolution. What happened to all the life forms beneath the ice? Because life doesn't really cope too well with long periods of low temperature. So there's a lot of things that conflict. It's not just one simple, straightforward, progressive evolution theory. There are many problems in the rocks for evolution. I want to suggest to you that the best explanation for fossils and the rocks that contain them is actually provided in the Bible, in the story of the great flood, of which we read in the book of Genesis, chapter 6 and 7. It's often called Noah's flood. It wasn't really, it was God's flood, and he told Noah about it and told Noah to do something about it. Let's consider the kind of things that we can read, not necessarily on the lines of the story in Genesis 6 and 7, because the story in Genesis 6 and 7 is told for another reason. But if you will, reading between the lines, inferring what is reasonable to expect during a gigantic flood. In terms of fossilization requires erosion and destruction everywhere. It requires creatures to be rapidly buried in flood-borne silt, then cementation or petrification to occur in a short period of time. And if we're thinking about a global flood, such as is described in the Bible, the more mobile creatures would escape the effects of the flood longest. It would flood the lower levels before the higher levels. So those creatures that are more mobile will be able to escape longest the effects of the flood. So I'm suggesting to you that the layers that have been built up in that huge flood represent zones of habitat, ecological zones, not chronological records over millions of years. Let me try and explain it with this slide. The bluish area at the bottom represents the sea or water bay bodies in which there live fishes, shellfishes, amphibians crawling out at the side, whereas on the land we have the reptiles, we have the different creatures that are found in the fossil record, some of which are now extinct, all the way up to man. And as you think of what would happen if a huge flood came along, those creatures that are already in the sea would be flooded, would be buried in the amount of silt and debris that's going to be generated, and would perish first. As the flood water rose, the amphibians and then the reptiles would succumb next. The more mobile a creature it is, the higher it will be able to go until it too becomes buried, because the Bible assures us that the flood did cover everything. And the last ones to be buried are the most developed animals, which can escape the longest. So I'm submitting to you that if you carefully think about what would conceivably happen during a worldwide gigantic flood, you get a better explanation of the fossil record in terms of ecology than in terms of chronology, the type of creatures buried in each layer belong to certain areas, certain zones of where they used to live. So fossilization requires rapid burial in flood-borne silt. These layers are layers of habitat, not a chronological record. They are the result of a lot of water, not a lot of time. And then, during the Genesis flood, other things happened. We have, in fact, told us in the Bible that, to use a phrase, the fountains of the great deep opened up. There would be violent stirring of the floodwaters. There would be violent upheavals in the earth's crust underneath. And all of this would further complicate the picture in the hydrological sorting of these creatures before they were buried. would cause the heavier ones to sink down and the lighter ones to float up. An extra layer of complication, which explains why some of, in the geological and evolutionary terms, some of the fossils get mixed up. They're not all in distinct layers. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. But if they're all stirred up like a big pot, like you ladies making soup, then the conglomerate will be found somewhere. And so you do find in the fossil record different types of creatures sometimes coexisting, whereas in other samples they are buried in separate layers. And then this huge geological activity would change the strata in a manner perhaps like this. The top picture would represent the still situation where these layers have all been laid down and the fossils are already contained in them. But as the flood begins to subside and tectonic plate effects begin to move, the seas get deeper and the mountains rise higher, and folding and faulting of these sediments becomes easily explained, so that Mount Everest, which I think is now something like 29,000 feet high, something like that, wasn't always that height. It got to that height after the flood, but it certainly wasn't that height below the flood, because after the flood, the effects, the after effects were immense, I believe, and caused folding, rising of mountain levels, depression of seabeds, to give the earth structure pretty much as we have it today. It is worth remembering that the world we live in now was dramatically altered by the flood, and to use the present model of the earth's surface as one that applied before the days of the flood is not really valid, because here are some of the things that did happen at the flood, we're pretty sure. The topography of the earth changed. Some things went higher, some things went deeper. Higher mountains, deeper oceans. The earth's plates, these gigantic plates that we hear about these days that cause earthquakes and tsunami and so on, this probably was given a beginning at that time. Continental drift may have separated continents. Volcanoes have been active, very active at some point in the dim and distant past. There are more extinct volcanoes than now than there are active ones. The atmosphere around planet Earth was bound to have changed. Before the Earth, there is good evidence that there was a water vapor canopy which acted as a protection to life on Earth. And from that vapor canopy came the immense rainfall that took place at the flood, and consequently, with all that water out of the atmosphere, less benign climate would take over after the flood, which would mean that some creatures that could survive before the flood had either to adapt, which some did, or else perish. And most of them did perish. For example, dinosaurs and Stegosaurus and them all, they weren't able to cope, because the conditions after the flood were so dramatically different from before. And for ourselves, for the human race, the world had to be repopulated. And there are three distinct branches of the human race known just now. And the Bible says that Noah had three sons, there were three couples, from which the whole earth was repopulated. And if you do a little bit of arithmetic and making reasonable assumptions, which I admit may not be totally accurate, but they're reasonable, you could get from three couples to the present population on Earth of around 6 billion people in something like 5,000 years, assuming an average of, shall we say, three children per family in stable times. That calculation adds up to the present situation that we're in terms of population of the Earth. Huge changes occurred after the flood. But then there are other things we're told about the flood in the Bible. Let me just run through one or two of them. The flood was certainly a violent episode. It wasn't a smooth, everyday flood. We've seen violent floods in the media recently, not least of which was the tsunami in Japan water can do a tremendous amount of damage. And even, dare I say it, the scale of the tsunami in Japan is nothing compared to the scale of what would happen at the flood. Because there were 40 days of incessant rainfall. The flood lasted for a whole year. It was worldwide. It covered all the earth, says the Bible. And furthermore, the cause of it was explained. I want to take a minute or two to talk about the cause of that flood. It's not directly related to the subject of fossils, although it does impact upon it, as you'll see in a moment, because the Bible wasn't written to tell us about fossils. The Bible wasn't written to tell us about the earth's surface. The Bible was written to tell us about ourselves and about our relationship with God. And we are told certain things in the Bible about why the flood came. The flood came because God saw the wickedness of man, but it had gone just that bit too far. The Bible says God is long-suffering. He doesn't really want to punish people for their sin. He would rather they turned from it and put their trust in Him and developed a relationship with Him. And yet, all over the world today, you can find fossils. And one of the things they do tell us is not the edge of the earth, but they tell us that God judges sin. That's the lesson of the fossils. They're there as relics, as evidences for this great flood in Noah's day, and they tell us that God is not away out there in outer space, ignorant of and unconcerned about what's happening on earth then or now. He does know. And sometimes He says, enough is enough. And God judges sin. But that's not all God does. Always before God judges sin, He provides a way of escape. He provides salvation. And He does that now, but He also did it then because He told this good man Noah to undertake a huge project to build the most massive ship. We call it an ark. To build the most massive ship that was ever built or thought of until the 1800s. A ship which would provide accommodation for Noah and his family and everyone else who cared to come on board, as well as two of every kind of animal and bird and creeping thing that could not survive the flood. And in a way best known to God, these animals came on board and they were preserved, and so was everybody else who chose to join Noah in that ark. So number one, God is a God of justice. He must punish sin. But number two, God is a God of love and a God of mercy and a God of grace. And He always provides a way out. He always provides a way of salvation. And in those days, He provided a flood-proof box, a flood-proof ark that He knew would survive the violence of that storm. Before the flood came, He gave a warning. This judgment, this rain, this flood is coming and coming soon. And Noah told people that. And they laughed at him. And they said, what on earth are you building a boat like that for in the middle of the land? You're not even near the sea. And as for rain, we don't know about rain. It's hardly ever rained. They didn't believe Noah's warning of judgment. But Noah wasn't only a doom and gloom prophet. He said, listen, there's an invitation for everybody to come on board. There's plenty of room for all who are willing. But only 8 people took up the offer. And more than that, this ark, this vessel, was guaranteed to be safe. And safe all the way, not halfway through the storm, and then it would sink or leak. No, it had safety built in all the way. And then when it was all over, there was a great rainbow appeared in the sky and the promise of further blessing to come to all those who had taken God's way of escape, God's way of salvation. I want to tell you it's the same today. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but much of what I've said about Noah is true today. Most people will agree that human behavior is getting worse and worse. what the Bible calls sin is becoming more and more blatant, and yet God wants people to be saved from the consequences of their sin. And he has provided not a flood-proof way of salvation, but a judgment-proof way of salvation. And you say to yourself, is that what I need? Do I need salvation? And you say, well, is it available? And is it available for everyone in this wide world? And you say, is it guaranteed? Will it last? Will it last not just through a year-long flood, but will it last forever? And I'm suggesting to you that the answer to all these three questions is yes, and yes, and yes. There is no person who does not need to be saved. Salvation is available to every person in this wide world tonight. And this salvation is guaranteed forever. Not guaranteed by a human being, not by a priest or a preacher or a parson or anybody, but guaranteed by Jesus Christ himself, who said, I only give you three of the many things, he said, that you can depend upon. He said, come to me, and I will give you rest. He is the ark, inverted commas. The ark is a picture of him, and he promises, if you come to him, he will supply what you need. He promises that if you come to him, he'll not refuse you. If you come to him humbly and in repentance, he will receive you. He never casts out, he never refuses anyone who truly comes and trusts him. And he says, I give to them, those who come, I give to them eternal life, and they shall never perish. It is guaranteed forever. My question is, what are you going to do about these words of Christ? Are you going to believe them, take them at face value, and act upon them? Because if you ask me for an opinion, you really should. I've done that, and so have many other people in this gospel hall tonight. But the message of the gospel is for everyone. Everyone here, and everyone in the wide world, who deserves judgment and punishment for their sin. Jesus Christ went to the cross and died so that our sins might be forgiven. And he simply asks us to come and trust him and accept him. And if you come, he'll give you eternal life. You'll never perish. And he'll never refuse anyone who simply comes in faith. That's the end of this part for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm looking forward to some questions later on. Thank you for these questions. If I had 20 questions and they each needed a minute to answer, we'd be here for 20 minutes, but it's not quite like that. I'll take these in the order in which I think they're best grouped. First of all, to do with rocks and rock layers. Somebody says, are the lower rocks older than the higher layers of rock? And if so, why? It appears reasonable that if you have a stack of anything and one sits on top of the other, the lower ones need to be there before the other ones sit on top, unless something pushes the whole thing upside down. So the answer is that the normal pattern throughout the sedimentary rock is that those which are lower down were laid down before those that are higher up. But that does not necessarily mean they are millions of years older than the ones higher up. If we accept the flood deposition theory, in the book of Genesis framework, they would only be perhaps days or months older than each other, because all these sediments were laid down when one single event. Why are there different types of rock layers? In other words, why is Jurassic rock of a different type to Cambrian rock? The different types of rock that are found in sedimentary layers have been caused by different types of sediment. So, for example, where I live, we've got sandstone, we've got shale, we've got slate, and all of these are different types of sediment that presumably had been washed off the land in the day of the Great Flood, had been deposited in some places in placid, flat layers, and compressed and turned into what we now have beside us. So the different types of rock are evidence of different types of sediment that was washed off the land in the first place. Can sediment or rock be dated by any scientific testing? The short answer is no. There's no radioactivity in these rocks, so they certainly can't be dated that way, although you can get an indirect guess at it by making certain assumptions. You see, anything that we don't have immediate experience of, if we're extrapolating, we've got to make certain assumptions. So if we were looking at a layer of sedimentary rock that, shall we say, is a meter thick, and you knew how fast sediment deposited to make up that meter thick of sediment, you could work out how old the bottom of that layer is compared to the top of that layer. But we've got to assume a uniform layer of sedimentation, which we can by no means certain about. So really, sedimentary rock can't be dated by any scientific means, but you will find the sedimentary rock is dated from the fossils it contains, but that means you're believing entirely that creatures evolved over time. Are any fossils being formed by gradual burying today, for example, large animals in the desert? As far as I know, the answer to that question is no. No fossils being formed nowadays, because we do not have flood conditions like we've been trying to prove this evening. Is it common to find fossils in most places? They are distributed all over the world, but there are certain areas where they're concentrated and certain areas where they're very scarce. For example, if you're in a landscape that is totally igneous rock, you'll not find any fossils there. You'll need to find an area where there's sedimentary rock, where there's limestone, chalk, sandstone, coal fields, shale. That's where you find the fossils, and they are on every continent in the world. A certain gentleman says that the theory of evolution would collapse if a rabbit was found in Jurassic rock. I don't think he meant a live rabbit. I think he meant a fossilized rabbit was found in Jurassic rock. Is he right to be confident that such will never be found? Well, he's not right to be confident that such will never be found, because surprises have turned up before in the sedimentary rocks. For example, there are samples of sedimentary rocks in which dinosaur footprints coexist in the same layer with what are pretty certainly human footprints. So dinosaurs and human beings walked the same earth at one point in time. Which brings me to another question about dinosaurs, if I can quickly find it. Dinosaurs lived 5,000 years ago and never got on the ark, or they would still be here. What do you think about this? Well, whether they lived 5,000 years ago or not, I'm not certain, but I am pretty certain that they did get into the ark. How did they get in, these big beasts? Well, Noah didn't need to take the full-grown adults, did he? I think it would make good sense that he would take little dinosaurs. But I'm pretty sure they were in, because they did exist on the world's surface at one point in time. And God said to Noah, take in two of every living creature. So I think dinosaurs were in the ark, okay. And a pair of them at least would come out the ark. But then they would find the conditions outside in the world after the flood were so different from what they were before the flood that they simply couldn't cope, and pretty soon became extinct at that stage. Okay? There's some interesting literature about dinosaurs on the back table if you want to check that one later. Why are there no human fossils, says someone? Well, to the best of my knowledge and belief, there are no human fossils, though I couldn't guarantee that absolutely. But on the model I've been trying to present to you this evening, where when the flood came, the more mobile creatures escaped highest, it would appear to me to be a sensible proposition to say that human beings would be the last creatures to perish in the flood. And they would drown, but probably not be so readily buried in huge sediments. That's the only reason I can give why there appear to be either none or very few human fossils. How old are the rocks was a question that was added near the end of the list. And my basic answer is, I don't know. I can suggest to you that they're no older than the date of creation, whenever that was, Because the Bible says, in the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. And if we stick to the earth, then God did make the earth and everything in it and on it. And so the date of the oldest rock is about the date when God made the world. And I'm not sure when that was. I don't think it was millions upon millions of years ago. My suggestion, it was tens of thousands of years ago at the most. And evidence for that, once again, I wouldn't have time to go into in 5 minutes, but there's some interesting literature on the back table that can take you further down that line if you wish to explore it. What is carbon dating, somebody asks. I did mention it in the passing. How do they do it? And why is it only good for measuring shorter periods of time? Fair question, because I did raise the point without answering it. In contrast to uranium-lead dating, the half-life of that process is 4,500,000 years. So that's suitable for measuring huge periods of time, because that's the kind of time that's taken for a gram of uranium to lose half a gram to become lead. Carbon dating is using an isotope of carbon called carbon-14, which has a half-life of, from memory, 7,500 years. I'm not just certain of that, but it's certainly so many thousand years. And if you try to use something that decays from a gram to half a gram in 7,500 or even 5,000 years, by the time you've gone to 10,000 years, you've only a quarter left. By the time you've gone to 20,000 years, you've only an eighth left. And the amount left becomes vanishingly small, not measurable, by the time any reasonable period of time up to 100,000 years has elapsed. So radiocarbon dating is really only used to date artifacts from archaeology which go back to around 2,000 to 3,000 BC. And there are reasons for doubting any that are older than that, because once again, in this system, there are built-in assumptions about the constancy of the process over these long periods of time. When one sees a sign in a museum next to a dinosaur specimen saying X 100 million years old, how do they calculate these numbers? They calculate them from that geological column diagram that I showed you. It is assumed that that is correct. And therefore, if the dinosaur fits in halfway up the picture, that's your datum, that's your line, that's how old it is. It is built on a theory that is by no means proven. So don't take these statements too seriously. Is there any proof that the flood was worldwide and not local? I can suggest two proofs for that. One is, it says so in the Bible. The Bible says that it did spread over the whole wide world. If it was local, there really would be no need for Noah to have built an ark. The things living in the floodplain, if it was local, could simply migrate somewhere else and there'd be no problem. But the other proof that the flood was worldwide and not local, to me, is that there are fossils worldwide. And the fossils all over the world show me that the flood was covering the whole world. One or two questions about the ark. How did all the animals fit on the ark? Actually, no problem. I know it sounds a bit odd when I'm glib about it, but somebody's done careful calculations based on the number of species of animal types, not subspecies, but the real species of animals that exist, even in the world today, taking two of each kind and seven of certain kinds for a special reason that's mentioned in the Bible, calculated what the average space would be for an animal to take up. And you think, what about the elephant? He's pretty big, even a baby one, and the dinosaurs I've mentioned. But let's not forget, there are actually far more small animals, and I mean really small ones, than really big ones. And on average, taking reasonable figures, it's been shown that there was space for all of these in the ark, and plenty of room to spare for more people if they'd wanted to come. Once again, if you want me to point you in the direction of a reference that will spell that out in detail, I can do so later. Do I believe that the world was once a large continent known now as Pangaea? I think that is extremely likely. Geologists have suggested from their models that the different continents of the world, which we now know are separate, once fitted together like a jigsaw. And if you look at the map of the Atlantic Ocean, for example, the chunk out of the edge of Africa, this way, and the chunk that sticks out of South America, that way, fit together. And there's good evidence from fairly modern measurements that there was once one huge continent, not split up by the oceans. And actually, there are certain parts of the book of Genesis in its early chapters which give that impression as well, that before the flood, it is highly probable, I couldn't prove it 100%, but before the flood, it is highly probable that it was one single continent and a huge sea, which of course got bigger after the flood, and the continent itself split up. It says, for example, in one verse in the Bible after the flood, that in the days of such and such a person was the earth divided. There is evidence, I think, both in the Bible and outside of it, that this Pangaea supercontinent, as it's called, was probably very real. But we weren't there to see, so we can't be absolutely sure. How do fossils tell us that God is real? They don't really. They simply point you in a certain direction. And if you want to find out if God is real, you've got to go somewhere else. Fossils can only tell you some things. I've suggested one or two things that fossils tell us tonight. For example, they tell us that there was a great flood all over the world. They tell us that God judges sin. But if you really want to know that God is real, you've got to go to the Bible and read the story of Jesus Christ, God's Son, who came into this world to tell us and show us that God is real, and to show us what kind of God there is, who is real, and who loves every one of us, and wants us to spend eternity in his presence. That's the best way to find out if God is real. And there's one more, which I should have taken earlier. Forgive me for getting all these bits of paper mixed up. But I don't want to disappoint anybody. It says, don't the caveman fossils prove we evolved? Not exactly sure what's in mind, but I suspect that what's in mind is the so-called evidences of ape-like ancestors. Neanderthal man, Java man, Nebraska man, which have been, in the majority of cases, proved to be frauds. People so desperately wanted to find a missing link between some ape-like ancestor and modern man that when they dug up bits and pieces of skulls or bones or even teeth and they looked a bit strange, out of the norm, then they said, ah, this is it. And the artists got to work. And the plaster of Paris people got to work. And they built up a whole structure, sometimes from one single tooth, which turned out actually, eventually, to be the tooth of a pig. So although these things are still touted as real, most of them have been exposed as frauds, and those that haven't have been shown simply to be remains, not fossils, but remains of individual members of the human race, whose skulls may have been deformed by a disease or other constraints or accidents or whatever. It is by no means certain that the so-called caveman things are other than figments of people's imagination to make them fit the theory that they want to believe. But for us all, what we believe and what we want to believe has got to stand the test of time, and more than that, it's got to stand the test of eternity, to which we're all bound.